Okay. This is our third in a series of Cast and Blast conversations. And this is the first time we've ventured outside the state to do one of these. I had the distinct privilege of going to Mississippi this past weekend. Yes, it's a distinct privilege to go to Mississippi. And while we were there, I went for a BHA event at Josh Raggio's Call Shop. And if you don't know Josh Raggio, he's one of the premier call makers in the country. He's based in Raymond, Mississippi. He makes all of his calls by hand. The guy is an artist. I encourage you to go Raggio Custom Calls on Instagram or Facebook, see his work. Anyway, he was super generous with his time with BHA, but also super generous with his time with me. And I was able to go hang out with him for a while. And we recorded an interview there. I'm still getting the hang of the remote recording situation. So bear with me on that. But I think it comes out pretty good. The content's good. The content's all there. So here is our first ever conversation outside the state with Mr. Josh Raggio.
Sitting here in, where are we at? Raymond, Mississippi?
Raymond, Mississippi.
With Josh Raggio of Raggio Custom Calls. And this is the first interview we've done outside the state, but this was just too cool of an opportunity. I've got to be out here with backcountry hunters and anglers for an event at one of your, you call them a call night, right? Is that what we usually call them?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what they just got dubbed, I don't know, a couple years ago. So, it was call night.
So for folks that don't know you, I've been following Josh, a buddy of mine, actually, you made a call for him. He played for the Braves.
Yeah.
And you made a call for him when his mom died. And he got the call, and I got to blow it in the duck blind, and I was like, man, this is a work of art. And I hadn't heard of you up till that point. It was about a year and a half ago. And super, like, I get chills just thinking about it because it was such a piece to him, but it was also a super functional piece of equipment. So I started looking in. And then our mutual friend, Rocky LaFleur, started doing some interviews with you on his End of the Line podcast. And it's, Josh and I were kind of pregaming a little bit, and I said, I don't want to rehash everything you've talked about with Rocky because he's done such a good job of unpacking your story and why you make calls and how you make calls. We're going to touch on some of those same things, but I'll put a link in our show notes to that series with Rocky so y'all can go listen to it if you haven't followed up with Josh. But tell us, who's Josh Raggio? Like, who's Josh Raggio?
Oh, total weirdo. Artist type, I guess. No, I guess some of the things that I've touched on, like if I wanted to be, you know, how would I want to be described by somebody else? I hope that somebody sees me as hardworking. Genuine is the main word that I like to hit on. I was in the corporate world for a long time, did that whole thing, and the call making started as a hobby and has turned into what I do full time. It was one of those things. I didn't do any woodworking early, early on. I literally didn't know how to turn the lathe on. So it turned, that little hobby turned into a passion that I just couldn't ever let go.
Okay.
And so, so now I'm the guy that makes duck calls for a living, of all things. And if you had told me that, when I was in college or even when I was 30, I'd say, you're crazy. That's not. But I love it. Literally love to come to work every day.
How long have you been making calls?
We're about to be on 7 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So not that long, really. The good Lord just gives people talents. Sometimes it takes a long time to find them. I feel like I was just giving a talent, and a passion for this, and just feel very fortunate and blessed to get to do it.
So, how many calls have you made?
I really don't.
You don't have a count? You wouldn't know?
No, I started 3 years ago when I cut a tone board. There's a piece that I cut off, that's where the reed and all goes. And I started keeping those. An old call maker, Billy Starks from Stuttgart, I was visiting him one day in his shop, and he did the same thing. And I said, Mr. Billy, do you care if I take that, if I do the same? I don't want to copy your idea, but I really think it's neat because you can actually keep up with how many calls you made. And so I started doing that 3 years ago. And at that time, it was like 150 to maybe 250. I think now doing it full time, one to two a day is good for me. It keeps me wanting to come back the next day. I don't get burned out. So, 400 to 500 just guessing. I haven't counted yet this year.
When you talk about your calls, it's Razzio custom calls, right?
It is.
Because a lot of what you're doing is within the materials that you're working with. Like, you go into some really, I was looking around a minute ago, you've got some unique, talk about that for a minute, like some of the unique stuff. I know you've worked with Fordite before, and you see a lot of weird woods. And
like, so I guess like the question is like, what makes it custom?
Right.
I guess, right? So what I do is somewhat of a niche compared to if you go to some of the box stores and see those duck calls. You know, those are mass produced calls. And what I do is I hand turn everything. So I start with a block of wood or a block of Fordite or whatever, mammoth tooth. I turn a mammoth tooth call.
Yeah.
You see, yes, I start with something and that's quote unquote from scratch, and I turn it into what I like to call functional art. I look at duck calls as art. The wood is the canvas, and you know, the finished product is the art. So, you know, and then also some of the custom stuff. When you order a call, I mean, you get to pick the wood if you want to, the band, different display types of ways that you can display a call, down to the sound, loud call, soft call, lots of back pressure, no back pressure. There's, you know, it's a musical instrument. And so, you know, and everybody likes something a little different. So I guess that's where the word custom comes into play.
How big of a challenge is it? Obviously, when you started making calls, you made them with, I'm not familiar enough with the process, but you made them with a pretty common wood.
Yeah.
How big of a challenge is it to get your sound right in some of these different materials, like an ivory or a Fordite? Like,
sure.
I don't even know what Fordite, it's like paint that comes off of an assembly line, right?
Is that? Yeah, well, if you imagine, Fordite is a generic term for, like in a car paint booth, when they would spray a car, you're going to get some drip that hits the floor. Well, it may be a red car. Well, then the next one we run through is white. Well, then you get a white. And
so
it's just
layers
of color of paint. Well, eventually they have to go in and chip it all that stuff out and clean the booth. And that's the Fordite calls that you see make. It's old paint.
It's beautiful because it's all these unique lines, especially when you turn it.
It's, yeah.
But how do you, like, is there a challenge there with the tone of your call within a material that's not wood?
That's a great question, because the sound part, your tone board of a duck call, I only use really 3 to 4 different woods and materials for those.
Okay.
So the Fordite call, when it's put together and you're looking at it as a whole call, looks like all Fordite, right? But if you pulled it apart, the tone board piece that's inside that barrel where the reed and the cork is a synthetic material.
Okay.
And it's called a sleeving process. So the Fordite is sleeved on top of that, but the actual sound part is a synthetic. On woods, I either use Coca-Bola, African Blackwood, or Bodot Hedge. So the burls you see, like on my Instagram page, you'll see a full burl call. Well, if you pulled it apart, the tone board is going to be Blackwood or Coca-Bola.
Gotcha.
Or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. That makes complete sense, because I couldn't figure out, thinking the density of whatever that exterior material, but it's really just a horn. Or
it's the aesthetic part.
The aesthetics for the sound is really being produced on that tone board with that reed.
Correct. And that's why I use only those few, because they're so dense and they're the ones that give you the best sound quality, you know, tone-wise.
Now, did you design your own reed?
I designed my own tone board.
Okay, your own tone board.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. That you can get really technical in that, and I won't, but basically you can buy a flat jig, which you still have to turn the insert, you still have to figure out how deep to drill it, how wide to drill it, all that, you know, your exhaust bore, all that. Then you put it in the flat jig and you cut it. And then at the end of the tone board, it's a 90 degree, is square, right? And if you blew it would give you no sound. So you have to start filing and sanding, and everybody that's pulled a duck call apart sees there's angle, you know, at the end of the tone board.
A slope almost.
Slope. So you file and sand until you get a sound. And then you get a sound, and then you're looking for the right sound that your ear as a call maker likes. And that process took me about 6 months and a lot of
fine-tuning and
a lot of frustrating nights. You know, I was doing it after my full-time job. My first child was born at that time, and I was working in a garage, didn't have a shop. So I'd have to go get in my truck at midnight, blow the call, get back out, because I didn't want to wake anybody up. And so it was a fun process. The reason I did it that way, two reasons. I wanted to be respected by the older call makers, you know, when, because it's all about that tone board. That's the duck call. The other is wood turning. You know, the tone board is what makes the call. Didn't want to copy anybody's.
Right, you wanted it to be yours.
Didn't want to modify somebody's and then call it mine. I wanted it to be mine. And so I could put my name on it. And so that was one of the reasons I did it. The other was, I knew when you start that way, it forces you to learn the dynamics of the tone board. So if I sand here, how does it affect sound? Or if you want a call that has more back pressure, if I sand here, or how to take it out, it forced me to learn
that. Trial and error process of tuning.
Absolutely. And so I think as a call maker, that's pretty important to know. You know, if I'm going to call myself a call maker and do this full time, I better know how to do that, in my opinion. That's
how difficult is it for you to source materials?
It's always a challenge. You know, I have my guys that I use pretty much, you know, I've got it narrowed down to the guys that produce really good quality wood. And there's others out there that I just haven't tried. I'm sure that, you know, it's not everybody has everything. So you have to figure out who has this type of wood that you need, or this, or, you know, they're out there. A lot of those guys are some of my best friends. We talk on the phone almost every day.
I imagine that's because you don't work with somebody on a daily basis. Those are the people you work with, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I'm here in my shop pretty much by myself, but I'm always, you know, as I'm making calls, obviously I have to, you know, replenish my supply. So, you know, that is, if this shop burned down, I'd cry about a lot of stuff, but those wood blanks,
that would hurt. that'd be the thing that hurts the most.
That would hurt.
Yeah, because I can't imagine the amount of investment in that.
It would blow your mind.
Yeah, it would, and there's a reason your calls go for the numbers they go for, and it's because you've got your time, but you've also got a big investment in the materials that go into that. It's not a small thing.
No,
but you can see that in the craftsmanship and in the materials themselves.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, my thought process is, if you start with the best, a grade A piece of wood, hopefully it helps you end up with a grade A, you know, finished product. So
we're doing this in your shop.
Yeah.
You've been in the shop a couple years?
I've been in this shop for 4 years now. We moved here 4 years ago.
So folks can't see the wall, but I'm going to post a picture of it. You've talked about that on Rocky's show too, but tell them about your Gibson guitar story and how you got to the wall.
Yeah, so I visited the Gibson guitar factory in Memphis when I was up there one day, and when you walk in to start the tour, there's some guitars lining a wall, and there's signatures on the wall. And then we went through the tour. That caught my eye, obviously, because I do play the guitar. And I noticed, I was looking at all the, you know, famous signatures on the wall. Well, then you got to the end through the tour, and they had a big banner at that time, and it was full of signatures of the people that had actually come through and done the tour. And I thought, you know, how cool would it be for everybody that comes through the call shop to leave their mark on the wall or somewhere? And it ended up being the wall.
So you did this with like pallet wood or old farm wood or
something? Pallet wood, yeah. And so if I do ever move, then the wall's going with me.
You take it with you.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's, you know, when people just sign or date, some people draw, some people write quotes, you know, I mean, when I sit here and I'm taking a break from call making, I'll grab the guitar and I sit where you're sitting and I just can stare at that wall and just, you know, it brings back lots of really good memories.
It's unique to me because I've seen names up there that I know those folks.
Yeah.
And I'm not here at the same time they are, and they've signed that wall, now I've signed that wall. That's,
yeah,
that's pretty cool for us, like being folks that aren't in this room, but you come in and you're like, wow, you know, I see Bo came through here. I see whoever, you know, it's like, that's a pretty unique.
Well, I mean, it'll be like last night, you know, after having the event here last night, when I see like your guys' names on the wall, I'll think
of the BHA,
of the BHA event. I mean, how fantastic it was last night. And just, I mean, it was just a really good time.
Yeah. Know? Anytime and you get a group of hunters and fishermen together, it's a good time, right?
It is. It is. And then, you know, I'll think about doing the podcast today. You know,
right.
So, I mean, it's just, that wall is just full of memories.
So, I don't think you've talked about this yet with Rocky, but I'm a hunting and fishing guy, so I work in the outdoors industry. You're a duck call maker. You work in the outdoors industry. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of folks now, particularly with the advent of social media, everyone wants to be in the industry. And I choose not to challenge that. I choose to encourage it. Like there's smart people out there that haven't made a duck call yet or haven't invented a fishing reel yet or whatever. What are some things you could say as somebody that you're always pushing, but you're at the top of a mountain, so to speak, as far as where you're at, but you're going to you keep pushing and keep hustling. But what are some things you tell somebody that's kind of dreaming about this? I know that's a hard question or a loaded question.
Well, I can tell you this. If you get in the business, you don't get to hunt and nearly as much.
You give up your weekends and your nights.
Because demand obviously goes, it's a seasonal business. Fortunately for me, that's a general statement. Fortunately for me, it's not, because what I do is such a slow process. I stay a year or so behind on orders. But for a lot of companies, it's seasonal. And your big season is during hunting.
Right.
That's when your peak is. And so, be careful sometimes what you wish for. Getting in it is fun, no doubt. I get to meet people that I have, we share a lot of common interests. The relationships you build in the industry are awesome. However, just know that there's a good chance that if you get to duck hunt 50 days a year right now, that might go down to 5.
Right.
And that's just the way it works.
It's funny you say that you have a lot of relationships in the industry, because at the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers event that you had Devin Singleton here.
Yeah.
And Devin's your competition, right? Yeah. He's another call maker, but he's not. And you talked about this. Like you said, you go and talk to other call makers come here.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were other call makers in the room last night besides Devin. Like,
there were.
Talk a little bit about that, like the brotherhood you guys share there.
Yeah.
You don't view each other as competition. You view each other as together.
I personally don't. Yeah. We're all competitive. A lot of the guys that I'm friends with, we're all very competitive. However, there's mutual respect for what we do. We get how hard it is to make a call. We get how hard it is to run a business and to market and the county, just the whole side of owning a business, right? We understand it. And then the whole advent of the social media, and there's some, the negative that can come with that. We bounce, something happens, and a call maker called me and said, "Man, did you read that?" I said, "Yeah, you gotta have thick skin."
Right.
You gotta let it roll.
You're almost
off.
Like a support network for each other.
Somewhat, yeah. Yeah. But I look at it as a brotherhood in that sense. I have guys call me a lot, just ask me call making questions. To the guys here this morning, I was showing them how to do a specific thing on a barrel. I'm not real secretive like a lot of the real old call makers were. That was kind of the thing. They wouldn't tell you anything. And I get it, because they worked many years to get to a point to where they were, or to learn how to do that craft. They didn't want to share it. And that's fine. That's certainly your right as a craftsman. But I'm pretty much an open book, hence the mobile shop out there.
Right.
That thing travels around, and I turn a call in front of a lot of people. There'll be 10 people around watching me turn that call. I'm going to Real Foot next week to the call show. That trailer will be full of call makers and other, guys just buying calls, just watching. So obviously I'm not that secretive. When somebody asks, I'll help you do anything, a call maker, I'll pretty much help you do anything except your tone board. Because if I do that, then it's not your call.
Then you're giving it away.
Well, no, then it's...
You're copying.
It's not your call. If I did that for you,
It's interesting. So, I don't know how many folks will, but listening to you talk with Rocky, you were a college athlete.
Yeah.
You played baseball, and you played football for a year too,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, as a kick.
Kicker.
Yeah.
Is that a real football player? Or?
Depends on if he wins a game for him or not.
It depends if that guy gets through in your last line of defense on a return.
Yeah.
I use the analogy a lot in podcasting and guiding of the Alabama quarterbacks,
mm-hmm.
because you had Tua and you had Jalen Hurts. And Jalen Hurts, when it came time and Tua was better for the team, he's like, okay, that's better for the team, but I'm still going to go out here and compete every day. And I feel that's something we lose in the outdoors world, is we create like a tribalism.
Mm-hmm.
And really, we're all on the same team. We all want to shoot ducks, and I should be happy when you go shoot ducks, and you should be happy when I go shoot them, and
yeah.
You should be happy when you sell a call or he sells a call or whatever. And there's plenty to go around. But we get really wound around the axle sometimes around wanting to win, because we're all competitive.
Sure. Sure. I agree with that. It's business. We're also trying to put food on our tables for our family.
Exactly.
You know, it's our livelihood. However, it we are in it together. You know, at the end of the day, we want to go kill a big deer or shoot some ducks, and or, you know, just have that outdoor time together and that camaraderie, which is really what matters, honestly. So, yeah.
Let's pivot to that for a second.
Okay.
We go on a duck hunt together. We're mm-hmm. hanging in the duck blind.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys talk about?
Oh, man.
That you can say on the air.
Yeah. You know, life. It. A lot of stuff comes up in a duck blind that maybe won't come up in regular conversation. And, you know, and it's good. Because typically, and I, when I say that, I'm talking when you're hunting with your friends, your group, you know. You know, I don't know. There's bonds there that get created that can probably only happen when you're hunting. You know, you share an experience together that you know, is either about, you know, boat wreck.
Right.
Or on the other hand, you kill six limits of ducks that day. You shared something that just brings you even closer knit as friends. You know, a lot of it is just BS. A lot of it for me is getting is not serious talk, and a lot of it is just
picking on each other. And you're,
oh my gosh, man, my friend group is just, we're brutal on each other, like brutal.
But you can't wait for that, right?
And for some reason, we look forward to it. You know, I mean, we're tough on each other. But it's all in good fun, you know, and you can just really let loose and just be yourself. But, you know, I've mentioned this before. I used to get really jealous if I couldn't go on a weekend and my buddies went and they just whacked them, you know, like it would just eat me up. And something happened a few years ago where now I appreciate and I'm so happy for them. That maybe I did have, you know, something to do with the call business that I just couldn't go, and they get into them pretty good. Now there's a joy for them, and I don't know what that maturation. I don't know how that happened or when that happened exactly, and it translated even to now when I go hunting, I don't even have to pull the trigger to have the best time out of everybody in the group. It's just being out there, public, private, doesn't matter. It's being outside.
What is, you're in pretty good shape. Like you and I obviously have that common. Obviously, I'm a fitness maven. But what is your go-to snack in the duck blind? Because I don't hunt. We're all hunting in Florida. We're hunting out of a boat, so we don't have the same blind setups you guys do. What's your go-to food situation?
We don't really have blind. We're pretty much timber hunters. We're
still
but we have a boat, so we are cooking.
You go in. Okay.
The go-to is fried honey buns. Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what everybody looks forward to.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because I've not heard of it.
Yeah. And we carry those little, you know, the Coleman stoves in a skillet. Now, we'll take the sausage and eggs and all, you know, toast, whatever. But it's all about that fried honey bun.
And you just fry a honey bun? Unwrap it?
So the best thing to do is you cook your bacon first and get a little grease. Yeah. And you just unwrap honey buns. And it's about... I want to say it's roughly 1 minute per side. What it does is it puts a crust, this thin layer of crust on both sides, and it makes the middle just gooey. Yeah. And it is divine.
You need to trademark that before I hear this podcast. That's the greatest thing I've ever heard anyone say.
It's unbelievable. I mean, I don't even know. Words can't.
No, that's happening. Like that's one of the coolest things I've ever heard.
Oh yeah, it's fantastic.
So that's the thing that's part of the tradition, right? You got a box of honey buns.
One box doesn't do it. You'll eat four. You can put the whole dang thing in your mouth just about once they get that little crust and gooey like that, and it's in some hot coffee. Man, it just is. It doesn't get any better than that. And if it's cold, it's even better.
This is a weird question. So Do you make calls because of your passion for duck hunting, or do you duck hunt because of your passion for making duck calls?
I think it started out as I made calls for my passion for duck hunting. I wanted that sense of accomplishment of making my own call to converse with a wild animal and convince that animal to come in with something that I had made. That was the goal. I never planned on selling a duck call, ever. That was the only reason I started out to make one, was because I just wanted that fulfillment of, you know, like making a turkey call and calling him in, you know, with your own turkey call. There was something that just drew me to that. So that's why I started. It turned into just what I absolutely love to do. You know, and honestly, it's taken me away from hunting, because sometimes it's by choice. A lot of times I don't mind being in the shop rather than going hunting.
Replaced hunting somewhat.
Sometimes. Not fully, but I get as much enjoyment making you a duck call or somebody a duck call to get to use to go do what I set out to do when I first started, as I do hunting sometimes. Yeah.
So you mentioned turkey, and you and Devin at the event talked quite a bit about turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Have you made turkey calls for yourself, and do you foresee going down that road eventually? Or
I have. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago. You know, everything I do, I try to do differently than anybody else has done. So I decided just to try to make slate call, pot call. But what I did, a lady in Raymond makes stained glass. She's a stained glass artist, and we're friends. And so I had the idea to, you know, turn the pot, and then there's always a soundboard inside a pot call. And so what I did was I put together stained glass in a round shape, all different colors and, you know, just wild looking. And then I put clear glass on top, which is what you would actually scratch. Yeah. Which is not good really in Mississippi. It's so humid when it gets wet, you know, it just
holds moisture underneath.
Yeah, and you kind of lose your sound. But the idea was to create art in that, it was almost like a kaleidoscope. So when you put it up to the sun or the light, and that stained glass, you know, the light was shining through, they were just really different. I'd never seen anybody else ever do that. So I made 12 of them. I think I sold 8 or 9 and kept a few. And basically, at that point, I was just trying to break up the monotony of making duck calls and wanted to just try my hand at a turkey call. It's not my thing. I probably won't make any more.
Did you hunt over it?
Yeah, I killed a turkey with
you
one.
You did?
Yeah.
So you got that fixed?
I got that. Yeah. Yeah.
As you're talking about that, I equate it, a lot of our audience is fishermen in Florida, and I equate it to like a fly. Like there's a trick to, I want to tie a fly and catch a fish on the thing that I created.
It's
the same challenge, right?
Yeah, it's identical.
You're wanting to trick that duck or that turkey or that whatever.
With something that you made.
Yeah. Would you?
And the challenge, it's a challenge. It's
Do you Western hunting? Anything?
No, you know, big game. So I grew up on a cattle farm. And we still have it. It's been our family since 1900. And so for me to try to deer, and we have deer. We have big deer, actually. And to try to deer hunt, I would sit on a stand, and all you could think about was everything else you needed to be doing. And so I couldn't really ever enjoy it. And I didn't take the time to get in a lease or do anything else to hunt somewhere else to try to create that enjoyment of big game. However, I did, it was about 6 years ago, decided another bucket list thing, that I wanted to kill a buck with a bow. So I bought a few lock-ons. I don't climb. I hate heights. But I bought some lock-ons, planted some food plots, and killed a deer with a bow. I don't even know where the bow was. I hadn't touched it since. So
check it
was
it
awesome.
Off and you were good.
Yeah, like for that one hunt, and when all that happened, it was so much fun. I understood why people do this and why they love it. The funny part about it was I'd practiced shooting that bow all summer in shorts and a t-shirt. That hunt, it was about 35 degrees and the wind was blowing out of north about 15 miles an hour. So I was already cold, and this buck walks by me, and he was a young, you know, kind of brush rack 8-point. You know, he wasn't just huge, but I was going to shoot a doe. Like, I just wanted to kill a deer with a bow. That was the goal. So I stand up and I can't get my bow drawn. I'm so cold, I couldn't just pull back like I had done all summer long.
You were locked.
Could not pull the bow back. And he was kind of to my right, and I'm right-handed, so it was a little bit awkward trying to get turned. Luckily, he was young. He looked straight up at me and watches me for what felt like 10 minutes trying to pull that dang bow back. But finally, on the fourth try, I did the old, you know, where you got to start up high and come down. I had to do that.
Like the 8-year-old trying to?
Yeah. And I just knew, I was like, I mean, I can't pull it back. I was like, I got to do this. And he's just about to run off, and this is done. Well, he sat there and watched me do it, and I drilled him. And so that, you know, it was fun. It was fun. I've never been out west. What I would love to do personally is go with someone that's going on the elk hunt or going on a sheep hunt or whatever. I love just being, I want to see that part of the country. I would take in more of the camping or the rafting or whatever part.
The experience.
I really don't have a desire to.
I have a similar wiring. I'm not a game hunter. Duck hunt, I turkey hunt. I haven't shot a deer in a long time. It's just not my thing. But so I get that. Because with the backcountry guys, a lot of them are Western. They get after it.
Absolutely.
Josh, that's their passion. He went and killed a doll sheep in Alaska and did all this. I think it'd be amazing to see. And I'd love to eat some of it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But I don't have the desire to go after it or even put the time into it to understand how to go after it. I just want to experience the wildness of it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's the beauty of hunting. I mean, you don't have to like all of it. You know? I mean, some guys do, but you know, maybe those guys could care less about standing in knee-deep water, freezing their tail off, shoot a duck.
You know? Exactly.
I mean, they've never done it. They don't understand, you know. So, you know, that's just the beauty of hunting and outdoors is find what your passions are.
Who are your inspirations in the waterfowl world? I know your dad is one. You can talk about that, but also... Yeah. Even with a duck calling or whatever, like who, where do you get your inspiration from there? And then I also want to pivot to who your inspirations outside that, because I know you've talked about your mom on Rocky's podcast, being a creative.
I guess inside, you know, the community, there's a lot that have passed away. So as far as inspiration for calls, there's a couple of books out there that are you know, very educational, show pictures and talk about old call makers and things like that. And I just love to look through them, and ideas just start popping up, you know. There were some really creative guys back in the day. Alvin Taylor was one of them. You know, there's a lot of guys that, Mark Weedman, the Wheaties calls, he was one of the first to laminate acrylic together to make a duck call. Funky looking things, but you know, now they sell for like, you know, $700 to $1,500. So those were way outside of the norm. You know, Alvin would do an aluminum call or different things.
They were just innovators.
Innovators, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever. A lot of guys that paved the way for me to do what I do. Butch, Rick Dunn, you know, David Gaston. Those kind of guys that started out just like I did in a garage, basically, hand-turning duck calls.
Bought a lathe at a garage sale and started to figure it out.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, those are the guys that inspired me to say, you know, I can do this too. I at least try it, you know. So those are the type from a call, you know, call aspect. Those are the kind of guys that I look back and think, yeah, they're inspirational for sure. Yeah.
And then you're obviously your family.
Yeah.
You grew up in a water, like your dad was a duck hunter?
My dad duck hunted, yeah. He loved the calling aspect of it. He never made a call. But he loved the calling aspect of it.
Now, can you talk about the trailer that's coming out this week?
Yeah, yeah. It's so it went live today.
We're recording this. I'm not sure when this will go live.
Yeah, sure. So, it'll be out. It'll be on social next week.
We'll put a link to that. But can you talk about the film that's going to follow that trailer, kind of?
Yeah. So the brief story is my dad got really sick. You know. It was about 5 years ago, 4 years ago. He had a genetic liver disease, basically. And it got to the point where he really didn't have much longer. And it was just very obvious physically looking at him and different things. But I was at a Delta waterfowl banquet, and a gentleman came up and introduced himself to me and was just extremely nice. he had been following my kind of what I was doing, and just wanted to say
the call making aspect.
The call making,
yeah,
yeah. And I've been keeping folks up to date, kind of on my dad's progress in the duck call world through social. And I made a post a day or two after that event, and that guy that introduced himself to me sent me a message that said, "Hey, I didn't know your dad was sick." And he said, "My best friend and hunting buddy is the head of the liver transplant team here in Jackson, Mississippi." Well, we had been going to Ochsner's in New Orleans, and he had gotten on the list there, but he was way down the list. Well, because it was not so well known in Jackson as the as a liver transplant hospital, he was like number three. And so it was very, all of a sudden, like we had a chance, you know. And a month later, number three popped up. It was his turn.
Wow.
And it actually happened, you know, on January 1st, which was also my mom's birthday. So, you know, so we're kind of telling that story and a little more of the details of that story. And also the call making part of it. We go on some hunts, and you can see some of that.
Your dad goes on a hunt.
Yeah.
You see that in the trailer. I mean,
yeah, it's a year after the transplant.
Your dad was at the event the other night.
Yeah.
And looks fantastic.
Yeah,
he's like, doing great. I would have never known he was sick until you told this story. So like, I get chills talking about that because
it's
he looked amazing.
Yeah, the turnaround and the transformation. You know, but on the other side of that, and we also hit this in the film, somebody had to lose a life for him to get his life.
Wow.
To keep his life. And that's pretty heavy.
Yeah.
When you think of that. So, you know, the organ donation is a big deal in our family. We support it. I do some auctions and raffles and things to raise money for Mora, just to bring awareness. And all it is signing, when you get your driver's license renewed, putting a heart.
Put a check.
Yeah. So it's a big deal for our family, obviously. So yeah, we're excited. The film will be out in November, but the trailer's released this morning. So
yeah, and we'll put a link to that and push it. And when we see that,
thank you. Yeah,
that come out. That's
we're excited. It's big for our family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What? I want to pivot back because you've obviously done stuff with Delta, done stuff with Ducks Unlimited, doing stuff with backcountry hunters and anglers. Can you talk a little bit about what conservation means to you? Like to Josh Raggio, not even Josh Raggio, the call maker, but Josh Raggio, the person.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's extremely important, obviously. You know, if you looked at duck numbers and what they were doing from a duck hunting aspect, you know, that conservation, DU and Delta waterfowl, is a big deal. It's if you look at a chart, you know, duck numbers, they fluctuate. But they've had a huge impact on getting the populations.
The trend
back
has been
up. Correct. You know, when you look at BHA income and conservation, they're our voice
for public lands.
For public lands, and you know, I want my kids to be able to have the opportunities that I have today. It's just too important to lose the public grounds. It cannot happen.
Right.
It cannot happen. And so, and it's happening, unfortunately, hence the creation of BHA and giving us that voice. And they're just doing such a good job. I think the grassroots part of BHA is I like it. I like it a lot.
I say it's always like the people I deal with BHA are super informed on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like whenever I talk to them, they mm-hmm. know about stuff.
They do.
Whatever their stuff is, be it in Mississippi or Florida or Georgia, they know the issues and they understand them. They can speak well. They're skilled hunters. They're skilled, you know, in the waterfowl world, they're skilled callers. They get after it. They go hard, but they also understand all the aspects of the stuff. But
they do, and it's evident on like the Facebook pages
mm-hmm.
That most of the regions have, you know. The talk is there's no drama,
right?
It's very serious. What's going on in your region? Maybe you know, guys posting their hikes or their kayaking trips or their hunts. you know, and like the trash pickup days. I mean, there's just so much good stuff surrounding it that there's just no drama. There's no there's no drama, and so it's really encouraging to see how it's organically starting to build and flow.
It's almost like you can see the positive aspect of social media, which is sometimes hard to find.
It's difficult sometimes to find it, but you can. I found it with some of these organizations like DHA. Yeah.
I have missed this part on your discussion with Rocky, but you wanted to be a professional bullfighter?
I did.
Can you fill in that gap a little bit?
So, I wanted to ride bulls.
Okay, first. That's what it was.
Yeah. Because, we, you know, like I said, we had a cattle farm, but I couldn't do it in college because I couldn't get hurt and lose my scholarship. So right after college, I get on my first bull and do it, you know, for a while, but I just sucked at it. I was too tall and whatever. I wasn't any good at it. But one day, nobody showed up at the bullfighters didn't show up at the practice pen. So I was still in good shape from college. And I jumped in there because I knew cows and angles and kind of how things worked. And it turned out I liked it, you know, and found a bullfighting partner. And we started traveling around doing all these rodeos. And I'm telling you, if I could have made a living doing it, we probably wouldn't be doing this podcast right
it
now.
It was so much fun. You'd be doing a bullfighting podcast.
Exactly. But it just
your custom bullfighter.
you just couldn't make
any money.
I couldn't make a living.
Not with, especially if you want a wife and kids.
Yeah, and that was when I was single, so it was a little different.
Right.
But it was still, I mean, I was working all week too, and you know, rodeoing on the weekend. But man, I loved it. The adrenaline of it, the fact that you were able to, I equate it to being a fireman. Most people are running out of a burning building. There's a certain person that's programmed to run in a burning building. And it's the same thing. Most people are running away from a bull that can literally kill you. There's a few people that are programmed to run inside of that tornado and get somebody unhooked or, you know, running, whatever.
What position did you play in baseball?
I was a shortstop.
Okay. Middle infielder.
Yeah.
Were you an on-base guy? Were you an all-glove guy? Were you a hitter?
I was really fortunate to be able to catch a ground ball and throw it to first base. I was a base hitter,
okay.
Wasn't a power guy. Obviously, you probably
get on base, steal base here, there.
Yeah, I stole 71 out of 72 bases my senior year of high school.
Wow!
And that's what caught
the scouts.
The attention. I was pretty fast, you know, just quick. And but I've been playing baseball since I was seven, so it had become very instinctual and. But I tell you, you get to a college level, and it's a whole another ballgame.
And you played at two different colleges.
Actually, three. I played junior college for 2 years here in Mississippi, and Meridian Community College. Then I went to Chicago for a year, and then ended up coming back and finishing my degree at a school here in Jackson, Bellhaven College. Yeah.
Do you still follow baseball?
I don't.
Not really, but you've made a lot of calls from bats. That's something that's unique that you see in your shop. Is pros or even minor, whoever, they give you a bat and they say, hey, this is from a game, or I hit a home run, or this is from...
Yeah, so they'll send me a bat and make duck calls out of it.
You'll cut the barrel and then turn that...
into a call for them in a stand, yeah. That started at my buddy Scott Rowe, who really was part of the... Nobody gets to where they get by themselves. You know, I've had a lot of help. And Scott was pretty instrumental. He was running a call page at that time and asked me to be a part of a sponsorship where I could sell some calls a certain day a week. And there was like 20,000 people on the page. And, you know, I was the small guy of the group of guys that he had asked to be a part of it. I was the no name. So that really helped me, you know, get to that point. But anyway, Scott had asked me to turn one of his bats, and that got it rolling. And then Dave Corley with Upper Duck had some connections with some MLB guys. So that's kind of that part got started. And now I'm good friends with Troy Snicker. He's the hitting coach for the Astros. He hunts here pretty close, and we're buddies. So I follow the Astros because of him. And went to some games this year and just had a blast. But, yeah, that's turned into a really neat thing.
Just like
the Braves,
almost, right?
Like, yeah, the Braves guy that we were talking about.
Oh, yeah, Tyler Pike, who played for Memphis. Yeah.
So it's...
The Mississippi.
Yeah, the story behind that, I don't know if he told you, but, you know, obviously he had gone through a really tough time. Well, the guys on the team found out that he duck hunted.
He duck hunts.
And found out about me, that I was here local, and they all put their money together, because you don't make much.
No.
minor league baseball. So they got their money together and they came over and they, you know, we talked and kind of picked out. And well, they let me go before the game and give a little spiel, you know, that it was from all the guys and set me other. And it was a pretty emotional time. He was floored. He had no clue that it was coming, you know.
I'd imagine that's a unique position you find yourself in a lot, because this is such a thing tied to heritage and tradition, and it's a special, you're not making $30 duck calls. So these are things that are for traditions or for
heirlooms.
So you get to see a lot of those moments for people, which is why you have all this personal stuff that you want to tie back together, right?
Because yeah.
You get to see some folks at very raw moments or very intimate moments.
I do. And I don't know if I made a post or read a blog about it recently. When I hand somebody their call, if they're fortunate enough to be at my shop or in the mobile shop at an event or something, when I hand them that call, I always look at their face. Because there's something that happens after they just watched this block of wood turn into a duck call. It's really hard to describe. It's a very special moment for me every time it happens. But I've been in just some, it's amazing where a duck call has taken me. You know, I was able to stay at Jerry Jones's.
You made calls for the Jones family, right? Jones Jerry, family. Steven, and his grandson.
And then they kind of, their friend group came for 2 days to the mobile shop at his place and to make calls for him. I mean, who would ever thought a guy from Raymond, Mississippi would get to have an opportunity like that, you know? And again, didn't get there by myself. A good friend of mine, you know, set me up with that. And so, I don't know, it's just those relationships and the friendships that you build that's really helped turn what you're looking at in this shop, you know, into what it is.
Now, we're going to wrap up, but you said you can get on a waiting list for a call, but generally speaking, if someone will come to you, make an appointment, come in, they can leave with a call.
So, yeah, that's the way to get to the front of the list. Yeah, so the past couple of weeks, I've had guys drive 6 to 10 hours to come, and I'm humbled by that. But we'll spend the day. We'll go to dinner. It's your time. You know, if you take the time to come to this shop, you're going to leave with a duck call.
Yeah. That's amazing.
But there's not a waiting list right now. I'm still working on last year's orders.
Right, because you only open it up, and you, I think
once
you said
year,
on Rocky Show you opened it up.
It's like a day.
You didn't even
two.
Announce you opened it up. You just turned it on, and it was gone.
It's amazing that people paid that close attention. The goal is this November to open the books back up for 2020 calls. Is what I'm shooting for.
Now, is your lady McCall? She works with you?
She does. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you hire her because her name is McCall?
Isn't it that not the greatest name?
Because
in a duck call.
Yeah, we've made more McCall jokes in the last 24 hours. The VHA guys and I like that's like a who's on first perfect scenario.
I know.
Did you have no one named Reed that applied? Did you have no one named Drake that applied?
I didn't put it out there for application. She was a friend of my sister's and just worked out. Her fiance and my sister's boyfriend worked together, and we were talking. I was getting pretty overwhelmed in here. I have a lot of irons in the fire. The wheels never stop turning for me. I'm always thinking about what can I do next? What can I do better? How can I separate myself and do something unique nobody else has ever done? And so I get all while trying to make calls every day, right? And so I was getting overwhelmed. And my sister and I were actually talking one night, and she said, you really ought to just consider hiring somebody to help you do things, very simple things, like running the post office, you know, helping box up calls, she was a huge part of the BHA event last night.
And she's a photographer.
She's a photographer.
So she's able to help you out with social media on getting images or post. You know, it's like.
Yeah. So we can take pictures every day now.
Right.
You know, in the shop. She's a graphic designer. So she's really helped, kind of helped me get a little more focused. Even just getting the whiteboard and writing down what are we doing today.
Right.
You know, things like that. Just keep me on point. So she's been perfect. She's awesome.
She seems awesome, but one of the greatest things ever is her name, McCall.
And she's also from Fargo.
Really?
Yeah. So if somebody call, if I'm, you know, I may have my headphones on and I'm just, you know, neck deep in a duck call and somebody, you know, the phone rings, she'll answer it every now and then for me, and they're stumped at the accent. Because you don't typically call Mississippi and get a Fargo accent. You know? Guys come by, you know, come by the shop, visit or whatever, and it just, it's a breath of fresh air. That's for sure.
Josh, where can people find you on social media?
Mainly Instagram, at Raggio Custom Calls. That's where I really, I use that as a portfolio for one. I also use it to try to tell my story. I put process picks up, try to create a brand that's very captivating from a picture standpoint. Also, obviously, Facebook. And then I have a website, RaggioCustomCalls.com, I'm on Coffee Line too. You can get that on there. If you ever want to schedule.
Can you tell us about that? You get your own coffee.
Yeah.
How does that, like, do you?
Well, I figured every duck hunter, 99% of duck hunters drink coffee. So I probably ought to have coffee. So I have a roaster that we went and I tasted 40 different beans, you know. And so what you do is you put 10% of this one in and 20% of this one. If you want a dark, you know, you got to have Sumatra in it. That's the dark.
You a dark roast guy?
I prefer dark. We created two very flavorful coffees. Really, it's medium and dark. It probably should be called light and medium, honestly. The Double Barrel and the Gentleman is what they're called. Double Barrel being the dark.
Can folks buy that on your website?
You can get it on the website.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you also do some stuff with Filson. We didn't talk about that, but I know you do some.
Yeah.
Folks can get your calls through some Filson.
Yeah, they last about
a minute.
Usually about an hour. Yeah. The last batch we went up online a few days ago, and they're gone. But yeah, that was a really cool experience. I've been a Filson fan forever.
Uniquely American
quality.
It aligns really good with what you do. Your brand.
Iconic brand is what they are. 122 years old, still going strong. And yeah, they reached out through Instagram, the creative director, and asked if they'd never carried a duck call ever. But liked what I did and asked if I'd be willing to do some, and it's turned into a really cool partnership.
Did you say your mom makes every pouch?
She makes the call bags for Filson. Yeah. She did that early on when I first started selling calls. She made them, and it got just to the point where she couldn't
keep up.
But yes, yeah, so Filson sends us either the tin cloth or the shelter cloth. They're go-to materials, you know. This last batch, we did shelter cloth, and so it's different. The previous had been tin cloth. So, yeah, she sews those, and yeah, you know, it's a neat deal. I mean, and whoever thought that, you know,
this guy
in Raymond, Mississippi, one man show, would have a partnership with Filson like that. I have to pinch myself on that one.
Well, we appreciate how hard you work and the energy and the effort and the passion you put into this thing that is a waterfowl thing. It's a big deal.
Thank you. So
thank you for your time. We appreciate
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Thank y'all.
Thanks again for listening to Cast and Blast Conversations. If you're loving this show, would you please do us a favor and tell one of your friends about it? Maybe get them to check it out. Also, if you haven't ever left us a review on iTunes, that is the bread and butter for how folks can find our show. So make sure you go to iTunes if you have an iPhone or iTunes load on your computer or whatever, and leave us a review, 5 stars preferably. If you want to leave something other than 5 stars, I'd encourage you to send me a message or email and let me know why. Thank you guys so much for listening. Hope you have a great week.